pressed her back against the wall and stared out the front door, dumbstruck. Despite 12 years of agency training, she felt her chest tighten and her mouth turn into dry desert sand at the sight of the Syrian terrorist strolling along Connecticut Avenue.
As if he had the right to be here.
Watching him, she swore softly through her clenched jaw.
Sarsour, as if he had the right to even live. The man is a beast.
The ruthless killer hadn't yet seen her, but he wouldn't know her from Eve if he had. But she knew him. The picture she had printed out for her boss just hours ago was now a living, breathing man. At this very moment, her boss, Barry, and 12 other agents were at the airport attempting to intercept this madman and his deadly Syrian team. Now, all alone in her office, Jill watched him pull out a cell phone and angrily punch numbers in with violent stabs.
Sarsour is also alone. Was the anonymous tip describing Sarsour and his team wrong? Or had his plans failed? Or had he slipped through Barry's fingers at the airport? Where was Barry anyway? And why was Sarsour in our neighborhood? And what am I supposed to do with this madman while I wait for the other agents to return?
Sarsour looked exasperated, as if no one had answered his call. He jammed the phone back into his pockets. In seconds, he would walk away a free man.
Secretary or not, I have to do something. Should I approach him and strike up a conversation? It's risky, but it might work. I'm a woman, aren't I? And I have another thing for me. I may be Jill to my friends, but I'm Jamila to my family. We're Syrian, too, which is why the agency checked me out more than most of the other candidates. Trustworthiness is everything with the CIA.
In the end, her command of four languages and a detailed knowledge of Arab customs worked in her favor, like now with Sarsour. She forced herself to breathe and think logically.
Can I gain his trust? Can I get him in the building? Then break away and call Barry? But will he turn the tables and take me hostage?
Frustrated at her indecision, she squared her shoulders.
Time to get the man's attention.
Assuming the most confident expression she could muster, she moved towards the door. Beneath her outstretched fingers, the glass door felt like sheets of ice as she slowly pushed it open and stepped outside onto the sidewalk at the precise moment Sarsour turned in her direction.
Hurry, Jill, or you'll lose him.
Closing the gap between them with purposeful strides, she caught his gaze and held it, then raised her voice just enough for him to hear her say in fluent Arabic,
I've been waiting for you, Sarsour. Come inside where it's warm.
He stepped back, every muscle tense. His wary expression didn't soften one iota. His dark glaze raked over her, then settled on her face, his own sharp features etched with a frightening intensity. Undaunted, Jill tipped her head towards the glass door.
You'll be safe in here.
She maintained eye contact, willing herself not to shift her gaze or even blink.
It's much warmer in my office. Trust me.
He paused, his light jacket offering little resistance to the cold and rain now coming down, then sauntered past her, hardly noticing the people around them. Moments later, he stood next to her in the stillness of the brightly lit lobby, glaring down at her, entirely too close for comfort. Who are you? The Arabic words sliced the air like knives. Tell me.
I'm Jamila.
It was a common enough woman's name. No real danger in letting him know it. She turned on her heels and strode down the hall towards her office, mentally searching for another familiar name from the morning's briefing.
Farouk arranged this. You're to remain here until he comes for you.
Sarsour closed in behind her. The heat from his breath warmed the back of her neck. Farouk said that? Why didn't he tell me?
A last-minute decision in view of your failure this morning.
His angry expression shifted to guarded resignation, a seems miscalculation. He paid with his life. Shrugging, she turned back towards the door to hide her relief.
It's working. He thinks I'm on his side. An insider he hasn't met yet, an ally.
Stepping inside the shadowy office, she flicked on her desk lamp. Nothing in the room hinted of government work. Her office might just as easily house an accounting firm, as the sign on the door indicated. She eyed the top drawer where her Glock 9 handgun was hidden from view. As her security clearance and job classification had increased over the years, so had her need to learn how to handle a gun. The joke around the office was that her aim was so true, she could nail a terrorist between the eyes from 100 yards.
Not that anyone ever expected me to try. I have a desk job, right? Right. Until today.
Hanging her coat in the closet, she grabbed a gray cotton throw. Then, with her free hand, she waved Sarsour into a small, dimly lit room next to her office. Sparsely furnished, it provided a place to sleep when the workload got too heavy. Not a holding tank for a terrorist. Sarsour settled into the couch, still uneasy.
Your jacket looks damp from the rain. Let him trust me. Please, please let him trust me. I'll hang it near the heater for a few minutes. This throw will keep you warm while it dries.
He slipped off his jacket and gave it to her, making it abundantly clear that trust had nothing to do with it. She fought the urge to stare at what the flimsy fabric had concealed. A worn leather holster holding a Glock 35, made completely of plastic polymers, undetectable and highly illegal. Though the pistol was safely stuffed inside his holster, the outside snap was undone.
He could kill me without warning, for no reason whatsoever.
The stark reality of it didn't frighten her. It infuriated her. Calmly, she continued. Syrian names from the morning's dossier poured from her lips as naturally as if she chatted with terrorists every day of her life.
What about Gladiel, Makin, or Yakub? What happened to them?
Dead. All of them. He ground out the words. Dabir too. His eyes sparked fury, fury mounting in the black depths. But we took out our share as well. 5 of those CIA pigs are dead. Dead? Her heart squeezed into a hard knot.
Not pigs, my friends. Fighting for control and trying to look disinterested, I offered him a drink.
He shrugged. Water is fine.
I can do better than that. I have some eggnog. There's no rum in it.
Seemingly satisfied, he emptied his glass. She reached for the carton, surprised to see how steady her hands were, then tipped her head.
More eggnog?
Waving his left hand dismissively, he fell against the couch, exhaustion written all over his face. I haven't slept in 2 days. Leave me alone for a few minutes, but watch the door. Closing the door, separating them, she slid into a worn chair.
No sign of Barry or anyone else. Can I risk typing an email? If he wakes up and sees me at the computer, he'll demand to see what I'm doing. And if I call Barry, then the conversation would surely waken him.
Jill stared at her desk drawer, picturing the gun inside. The few minutes ticked by as she swallowed her fears and prayed. A sudden rumbling from the room next door stopped her heart until she realized what it was.
Snoring! How dare he sleep so soundly after killing 5 of my friends? 5! Men with whom I've worked and trained and studied.
Even men she'd beat in target practice. Well, she had a target now. A picture began to form in her mind. Jill, the gutsy secretary, the hero of the department, the woman who took down the man who killed 5 agents and untold civilians.
Easing the desk drawer open with my trembling hands, I lifted out my weapon. I have a license to carry a concealed weapon, but not a license to kill. In self-defense, yes, but a sleeping, defenseless man? But he's not defenseless, Jamila. He's armed, and he's a cold-blooded murderer.
She rose and walked around the front of the desk, her footsteps soundless on the thick carpet, holding the pistol safely out of sight. Easing the door open, she looked in at him, her thoughts reeling.
5 of my friends lay dead because of him. 5 women will learn today that they are widows, and their children no longer have fathers.
Her grip on her gun tightened.
Sarsour deserves to die. He's evil itself, deserving the same mercy that he gave his victims. None.
She slipped off the safety and shortened the distance from the barrel to his temple. Her heart was pounding so loudly in her chest, she feared he might hear it even in his sleep.
Can I kill a man and live with the consequences? Yes, I could kill this man. But should I? It's more than illegal. It's immoral. But so is he, Jill. So is he.
Gripping the guns with both hands to keep it steady, she pointed the gun at his temple.
That story was adapted from a pretty interesting book called Really Bad Girls of the Bible. You might be wondering, what on earth are we doing here? That didn't sound like a Thanksgiving story. What place does a story about terrorists have in church? And what does this have to do with our series? What in the world are we doing? Well, like I said, it's a modernization, a modernized rendition of a story that is actually in the Bible, believe it or not. It's found in the book of Judges. And it is really, I believe, although there's a lot of layers to it, it's really a story about choices, which in a lot of ways is what this series has been about. Here's the deal. The choices that we make will always have far-reaching consequences. And they can be good consequences, like the choice, the impact that Rich's life has on children because he chose to become a foster parent, or the hope that Brian gives to people who are suffering with diseases like he has done, or the babies who will live because Kevin uses his knowledge of medicine and his ability to connect with people to counsel women who are in the throes of a difficult situation, or the new life of sobriety that people will find because Brenda chooses to take the good news about Jesus into the jail every week, or the warm welcome that people visiting the hospital receive from Emmy Sue, or the Bible training that Spanish-speaking women are receiving because Pat is sharing Sierra's messages with them every week, or the positive direction some teens will take because they did art and hung out with Matt instead of tagging the neighborhood in your house. The choices that we make as a church will also have far-reaching consequences. Dale helps us be better stewards with the resources that God provides through your offerings, and how we, as individuals in a congregation, choose to use our money, whether or not we're able to meet our budget this year, will determine the future of our church and the future of the programs that we enjoy. The people who started Sierra many, many years ago paved the way for this church. I remember when we were thinking about adding on to the back, we actually doubled the size of this room. And the project before that, long before I got here, was to double the size of this first half of it. And we put a piece of tape on the line where it started. And those people that went before and chose to sacrifice and build doubled that. And we, in following their example, chose to sacrifice and give and build. And we doubled what they had left before us. My point is this. the choices we make as individuals and even as a congregation will always have far-reaching consequences. Now, like I said a minute ago, we're going to wrap up our series with a very unusual story, admittedly, because at its heart, I believe it is a story about choices. And so let's look at the story of a woman named Jael, and it's told in Judges chapter 4. And like I said, the story that we just read for you is really a modern rendition of what we read in Judges chapter 4, and I want to read it just so you know I'm not making it up. So if you have your Bible, turn to Judges 4, and I'm reading from the New Living Translation. After Ehud's death, the Israelites again did what was evil in the Lord's sight. So the Lord handed them over to King Jabin of Hazor, the Canaanite king. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Sisera, who had 900 iron chariots, ruthlessly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord for help. Deborah, the wife of Lappidoth, was a prophet who had become a judge in Israel. She would hold court under the palm of Deborah, which stood between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the Israelites came to her to settle their disputes. One day she sent for Barak, son of Abinoam, who lived in Kadesh in the land of Naphtali. She said to him, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you. Assemble 10,000 warriors from the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun at Mount Tabor. I will lure Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, along with his chariots and warriors, to the Kishon River. There I will give you victory over him." Barak told her, "I'll go, but only if you go with me." "Very well," she replied. "I will go with you. But since you have made this choice, you will receive no honor. For the Lord's victory over Sisera will be at the hands of a woman." So Deborah went with Barak to Kadesh. And at Kadesh, Barak called together all the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali. And the 10,000 warriors marched up with him. Deborah also marched with them. Now Heber the Kenite, a descendant of Moses' brother-in-law, Hobab, had moved away from the other members of his tribe and pitched his tent by the oak of Zanaim near Kadesh. When Sisera was told that Barak, son of Abinoam, had gone to Mount Tabor, he called for all 900 of his iron chariots and all of his warriors, and they marched from Harosheth Hagoyim to the Kishon River. Then Deborah said to Barak, "Get ready. Today the Lord will give you victory over Sisera, for the Lord is marching ahead of you." So Barak led his 10,000 warriors to the slopes of Mount Tabor to do battle. When Barak attacked, the Lord threw Sisera and all his charioteers and warriors into a panic. Then Sisera leaped down from his chariot and escaped on foot. Barak chased the enemy and their chariots all the way to Harosheth Hagoyim, killing all of Sisera's warriors. Not a single one was left. Meanwhile, Sisera ran to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenanite, because Heber's family was on friendly terms with King Jabin of Hazor. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Come into my tent, sir. Come in. Don't be afraid." So he went with her into the tent, and she covered him with a blanket. "Please give me some water," he said. "I'm thirsty." So she gave him some milk to drink and covered him again. "Stand at the door of the tent," he told her. "If anybody comes and asks if there's anyone here, say no." But when Sisera fell asleep from exhaustion, Jael quietly crept up to him with a hammer and a tent peg. Then she drove the tent peg through his temple and into the ground, and so he died. When Barak came looking for Sisera, Jael went out to meet him. She said, "Come and I will show you the man you're looking for." So he followed her into the tent and found Sisera lying there dead with a tent peg through his temple. So on that day, Israel saw God subdue Jabin, the Canaanite king. And from that time on, Israel became stronger and stronger against King Jabin until they finally destroyed him. Wow. You know, Bill O'Reilly says his show is the no-spin zone. I'll tell you what, the Bible is the original no-spin zone. Janelle's story is really an interesting, and it has sparked a lot of discussion, and it provokes a lot of questions. Questions like, is it ever right to take a human life? Is it ever right to use trickery to accomplish a noble goal? Do the ends ever justify the means? I hope that today we will provoke you to get into some of those conversations with one another. They're all great questions, and we need to wrestle with them individually, but also with one another. We'll learn and grow a lot if we do. But I think the bigger lesson for us to learn from Jael's story is the importance of making decisions that are aligned with the nature and the mind of God. And we can learn a lot of things, but I want to focus on two principles from Jael's story. And I want to work our way to them by first asking, how did this woman end up in this tent having to make this decision? How did this all come together? What triggered it? What events led up to this decision? And the first thing we have to do is to go back to the beginning and try to get into the mind of God and try to understand where he's going in his dealings on earth so that we can align ourselves with him. In Genesis 15, God makes a binding pledge with Abraham that his descendants will, well, first of all, he'll have descendants that are as innumerable as the stars, he says, and they will always have a homeland. The land that we know today as Palestine and in Israel, and it's colored there in the yellow, that general area that Genesis 15 is talking about. And in verse 18 it says, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, to your descendants I give this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates. Well, about 600 years after that, Moses reminded Israel of that same promise as they stood on the banks of the Jordan, poised to enter the land and begin its conquest. But in Numbers 13 and 14, we read that the people refused to go in because they were afraid of the nations that were living in there. They were big and they were strong and they're mighty. And so God made them turn around and he made them wander aimlessly in the wilderness for 40 years until that generation who refused to go in died off. Then we come to the book of Joshua. And Israel, once again, is standing on the banks of the Jordan, poised to enter in and take the land. This time they obey, and they drive out the inhabitants from the land and take possession of it. Well, mostly they do. Under Joshua's leadership, Israel moves into Canaan and takes partial control of the land. They didn't go all the way. They didn't complete. They stopped short of full obedience. Joshua dies, and then comes the period of the judges. And this is a very chaotic period in Israel's history. It's marked by wild swings between peace and prosperity and severe oppression. And if you read through the book of Judges, which I hope you'll do this week maybe, you'll see a very definite pattern. And you can kind of add these to your notes if you'd like. First of all, it says that Israel did what was evil in the Lord's sight. And then they cry out to the Lord for help because they get hammered pretty harshly for it. God sends a hero. He sends a judge, someone to deliver them. And then they enjoy a period of peace. Usually, in Judges, it lasts about a generation or so. It lasts between about 40 and 80 years. And it's peace and it's security and prosperity. And then they do it all over again. You got this vicious cycle that you just can't miss if you read through the book of Judges. And because they get into this cycle because they constantly get off track with God. And when their decisions are tracking with God, their lives are characterized by peace and stability. But when they get off track, it all unravels. That really is a key to what we're going to learn from Jael's story today. 10 times in Judges chapter 1, it says that they failed to drive out the people. Let's take a look at verses 19 through 36. It says, the Lord was with the people of Judah, and they took possession of the hill country, but they failed to drive out the people. that were living in the plains there. Down to verse 21, the tribe of Benjamin failed to drive out the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. So they're still there. They showed mercy to a guy that gave him a tip, and he set up camp and started his own town there. Verse 27, the tribe of Manasseh failed to drive out the people living in Bethshan, and so they're still there. They never did drive all of the Canaanites out of the land, it says in verse 29, the tribe of Ephraim failed to drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer. The tribe of Zebulun, verse 30, failed to drive out the Canaanites. And on and on it goes. 10 times it says they stopped short of complete obedience. They failed to drive them out. They failed to drive them out. They had been told to drive them out. And he says, if you don't, see, God ordered the complete destruction or complete removal of these people, that they were dispossessed, because if they tolerated this kind of multiculturalism, he knew they would lose their identity and that they would adopt the culture and the religious practices of the pagan nations they were to be dispossessing, that they were to be driving out. And that's exactly what happened. In chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, let me read that for you. I'm still trying to get used to the necessity of glasses, so I'm fighting it, but I'm losing. Look what it says. This is what happened. The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim with a message from the Israelites. He told them, I brought you out of Egypt into this land that I swore to give your ancestors. And I said I would never break my covenant with you. For you, for your part, you were not to make any covenants with the people living in this land. Instead, you were to destroy their altars. Why then have you disobeyed my command since you've done this? I will no longer drive the people out living in your land. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a constant temptation to you. Look in verses 10 through 13. After that generation died, this is what happened. Another generation grew up who did not acknowledge the Lord or remember the mighty things he had done for Israel. And then that generation did what was evil in the Lord's sight and worshiped the images of Baal. They abandoned the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who brought them out of Egypt. They chased after other gods, worshiping the gods of the people around them, and they angered the Lord. They abandoned the Lord to serve Baal and the images of Asherah. You see, God warned them, if you tolerate these people staying there, then you're going to be corrupted by them. Not only, though, did they stop short of complete obedience, they capitalized on it. They made money off the people that they were supposed to be driving out but left there. Chapter 28, verse 1, it says they didn't completely drive out the Canaanites, so they forced them to work as slaves. Verse 30, they didn't completely drive out the people of Kitron and whatever. They forced them to work as slaves. Verse 33, they didn't completely drive out the people of Beth Shemeth and Beth Anath. They forced them to work as slaves. They didn't completely drive out the Amorites. Verse 35, they forced them to work as slaves. Not only did they not obey, they said, hey, there's a little bit of money to be made here. And so they put them to work. And they make money off of them. Here's the problem that I see in human nature, and we're no different from them. As long as we're fairly comfortable, we will tolerate a little bit of disobedience. We will tolerate a little bit of evil. I mean, you know, they got rid of most of them, so we'll tolerate it. In fact, we'll make some money on it. But when we do that, it will kill us. If we tolerate just a little bit of disobedience in our lives, it will kill us. It will get us eventually. What makes the story of Jael driving a stake through an enemy general's head, or Jill in our dramatization blowing away a terrorist? I mean, that's a hard thing. I mean, we read that and we're like, ooh. Why do we have that reaction? It's a hard... Noah said when I said, I know who I'm doing Jael. It's like, ooh. Lori said, that's not Thanksgiving. You know, I think it's hard for us to appreciate what's going on here because we do not really appreciate and really accept how evil evil is. We do exactly what this nation did, and we get used to it, and we tolerate a little bit of evil in our presence. And in fact, we can make money on it, and we do. But there is real evil in the world, and God demands that we deal with it decisively and completely. If we don't, or if we won't, it will kill us just like it did them. And there is real evil lurking in us, and we are to deal with it decisively and completely, or it will get us. And part of our issue also is that we're often swayed by outward appearances into thinking, well, they're not that bad, are they? Besides, you know, the money's pretty good. I think that's where we find ourselves as a nation. We've tolerated little disobediences, little presence of little evils. We've even made them seem normal. So normal, we accept it, we promote it, we consume it without even blinking. And it's killing us as individuals, it's killing our families, it's killing our churches, it's killing our nation. Well, back to the question, how did this woman end up in this tent having to make this decision? Bottom line is, Israel did that which was evil. They stopped short of full obedience. They did not deal decisively and completely with the evil that surrounded them. Jael is in this tent facing this decision because Sisera is in this tent. And he's in the tent because the generations before them failed to drive his people out as God had commanded them. They tolerated a little bit of disobedience. Jael is in this tent making this difficult decision because her husband, Heber the Kenite, left the place where he belonged and resettled near Kadesh because, it says in verse 17, he was on friendly terms with King Jabin of Hazor. You see, he moved closer to town. He moved in with the enemy, essentially, is what it's saying there. It was good money, probably. And he left where he should have been, and he got on friendly terms with the enemy king. Jael is in this tent making this difficult decision because Barak, the general, refused to obey God unless Deborah went with him and held his hand. You know, Judges 4:7, God through Deborah said, I will give you victory over Sisera, over him. But in verse 8, he says, I will only go if you go with me, you big chicken. Verse 9, she says, very well, I will go with you. But since you have made this choice, you will receive no honor. For the Lord's victory over Sisera will be at the hands of a woman. And when we read that for the first time, we immediately think, Deborah is going to be the one. Had he not made that choice, Sisera probably would have died at his hand on the battlefield. He would have never made it to that tent. And certainly, he would not be defeated at the hands of a woman, especially this woman. So let's get a couple of principles out of this. Number one, the thing I see that really strikes me from this story is that good decisions flow from a good life. And I would describe a good life as a life that is fully aligned with the nature and the mind of God. We are, as Johnny Cochran might put it this way, don't stray from God's way. Maybe you'll remember that. Good decisions flow from a good life, a life that has lived God's way, a life that is tracking with God. Do we ever get that perfectly? No. Well, we can sure be working on that and understanding more and more and more and bringing our lives into better and better compliance. Joshua and Caleb stand out among the people of Israel during this period especially the initial conquest of Palestine, because they were good leaders because of their good lives. They understood and conformed to the mind and the nature of God. They knew where God was going. They knew who he was. They knew what he wanted of them, and they conformed completely. They were ready to go for it when the other spies said, no, no, they're too big. We can't go here. And God turned them around and made them wander aimlessly for 40 years. They said, no, we can do this. God said it. We're gonna line up with him, and we're going that direction. The rest of them said, no, no, no. When they get back in, Joshua and Caleb are the only two of that generation that joined them. And their decisions are marked by their willingness to obey God completely. Listen, if you want to make good decisions, you have to get on track with God. Now, getting on track with God, I think, involves wrestling with some questions like, you know, what is God doing? Who is he? Where's he going in history? What's he expect of me? What offends him? What does he say about reality and about life? What does he say? What's he call evil? What's gone wrong with creation? What's gone wrong? Why is it such a mess out here? What does God say is the solution to all of this? You see, this is a lifelong journey of learning God and learning who he is and what he thinks and where he's going with us and what he wants of us and conforming along the way. Second principle is this. First one, don't stray from God's way. Second, don't compound bad decisions with more bad decisions. Jael becomes the hero in this story, in my opinion, because she gets back on track with God. She stops the cycle. I'm very visual, so I had to draw myself a picture. I'll share it with you. I think this is God timeline. God is going somewhere, starting back in Genesis 1 to the end of Revelation. It's going somewhere. God is doing something. It's not just random. And one of the things he says of Israel is, rid the land of evil. Go in and take possession of it and drive everybody out. And they said, well, you know, they're not that bad. And besides, we can make money off of them. It's pretty good money. Jael says, come on in. Take a load off. Trust me. And she ends it, for that chapter at least. Now, here's the deal. Usually when we talk about things like this, we find ourselves in a pickle, in a mess, we want to cry out like Israel did, help us, help us, and leave all the consequences behind. But our decisions always have consequences, and a lot of those consequences, if not most of them, stick with us. And so we will have to work our way out of those consequences. We can't just, God's not just going to erase them and make them go away. Some things will stick with us for a while, for a long while, sometimes for our whole lives. But you don't have to make bad decisions worse by compounding them by making more bad decisions. Start making good decisions. Let me give you just a little bit of practical example. It's really been an interesting time. If you think about the cycle of debt that many, many people find ourselves in, and we see the house of cards tumbling down around our ears now. So what we've been encouraged to do, and we didn't think it was evil, you know, to live on credit. And so instead of learning how to be disciplined with our money and be good stewards of our resources that God brings into our lives and provides us with, we said, you know, he's really not coming up with more. B of A will help me. And so I go out here and charge it and charge it and charge it. Pretty soon I'm buried in debt. But that's okay. My mortgage company says, hey, man, you're stupid to have any equity in your home. Leverage it, man, leverage it. And so we get all, you know, bummed out about this huge debt load we've got. And so we consolidate our bills right into our mortgage. We leverage it. And then, you know, we notice month after month we've got one low payment now. And it's like, wow, look at all this money I've got left. That's pretty cool. That feels better. The heat's off. So what do? Well, we pay everything down and we save, right? No. That's not how the cycle normally works. We spend it. Wow, I want this. Everybody needs a 42-inch flat-screen TV, don't they? I mean, I'm buying and buying and buying. And, of course, we didn't ever cut up the cards. And so what do we end up with? We find ourselves, again, buried in this pile of debt. And so, fortunately, the housing market's been on a rampage, so we leverage it. And we get ourselves down to one easy payment. And we do it all over again, and again, and again, and again. And pretty soon, somebody shakes the table, and the house of cards comes falling down. You see, we need to stop making those same stupid decisions and get on track with God with respect to our finances, for example. And break those cycles and get rid of those little benign disobediences and evils. I mean, it's not really evil to leverage your house, is it? Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is evil in God's eyes to live beyond our means. Check it out. Get your Bible and find out. That's the point. If you want to start making good decisions, you better start finding out what God thinks about things. You know, and there's just so many of those cycles that keep going and on and on. I mean, we could talk about the cycle of abuse. Man, I occasionally talk to women who are just getting pounded by an abusive husband. And they keep going back, and they keep going back. And then finally they get tired of it, and they split up. And then 6 months later, they're in another relationship. And guess what? It's the same person, different face. And we keep making these decisions, these bad decisions, and we keep compounding them. We got to break the cycles. We've got to get on track with God. How do you make good decisions? Well, you get on track with God. Why don't you bow your heads, and let's just take a minute. You know, we've been talking about getting on track with God and making good decisions accordingly. But what do you do if this is all new to you? And so new, you may not even know where the tracks are. Well, I think you've already taken a really good first step by being at church today. So keep coming and keep learning. Get a Bible and start reading it. If you don't have one, there are some out in the lobby that are cheap, or if you can't afford even that price, take one. Get involved in a small group or Bible study and ask a lot of questions. There's a really good place to start on Monday nights in the Vanek House. So if you don't know where the tracks are, find them. Well, maybe you did know where they were at one time, and you've gotten off track. Get back on. Don't compound things. Don't keep making bad decisions worse by repeating those cycles. Start wrestling with those questions that we talked about earlier. I've printed them in your notes so you can just start struggling with them. And don't just do it alone. Do it with other people. Read a lot and talk to other people and ask questions. Find out what God is about and get back on track with Him once you get off. You know, the really encouraging thing about Judges, it's kind of depressing to see their destructive cycles. But what is really encouraging is that God is always ready to accept us back when we've had enough. Take this time to just run back if you've left Him. Commit yourself to pursuing Him if you're not sure where He is. Lord, thank You for Your grace that is willing to forgive even when we keep blowing it repeatedly, which I have to confess, I don't think there's anybody here that doesn't. Lord, let us not take for granted Your grace and Your open arms inviting us to return. Help us to start doing things Your way. and to take seriously those little disobediences that we tolerate in our lives. Amen. I'm going to ask the ushers if you would come receive from our church family our offering. Remember, how you give, how you use your money, how you support this church has consequences. Don't forget, sign-up tables out in the back for the ladies. God bless you. Have a good week.
Faithfulness.